For another perspective on the much-discussed and debated issue of maintenance therapy, I met with Dr. Mark Sosinski, whose editorial on this topic recently appeared in the JCO. Dr. Sosinski began our conversation by commenting on the three ASCO datasets on maintenance treatment.
We had three trials presented in the oral lung session looking at the JMEN study, which looked at maintenance pemetrexed, and then the ATLAS and SATURN trials that looked at maintenance erlotinib. All the trials had a similar design. It was four cycles of platinum-based therapy. And if you did not have disease progression, so patients with stable disease or response, then you were randomized to either pemetrexed on the JMEN trial or erlotinib on the SATURN and ATLAS trials versus a placebo. Of course, the ATLAS trial was done in patients who were bevacizumab eligible. So that was the one difference between ATLAS and SATURN.
And I guess they actually had started out with chemo-bev and then kept the bev going and added their erlotinib in.
Exactly. So in all three trials, the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. All three trials were positive. The only trial we have survival data from is the JMEN trial, which was the pemetrexed trial, and that showed a significant advantage in overall survival. Also, the benefit in that trial was restricted to non-squamous histology. The squamous cell patients in that trial really had no benefit from maintenance pemetrexed. The interesting thing is, you know, I look at these trials as obviously, there's some element of patient selection. You have to make it through four cycles. I think the numbers on the SATURN trial was they entered about 1,100 patients and about 700 of them were randomized. So we realized that we lose about a third of patients through the first four cycles. Then, you know, you have 100% of patients getting early treatment that we call maintenance treatment. It's interesting that both pemetrexed and erlotinib are approved in the second line setting because we either know or believe that those agents improve survival. So this major impact on progression-free survival is not surprising to me, nor is the survival advantage. If you look at the control arms, one of the criticisms of all the trials is only about 60 to 65% of patients on the placebo arms of these trials ever got second-line treatment. So you can argue whether this is truly maintenance. Is it early second line? Is it sequential therapy? Does it just validate that second line therapy is important and that it's important to get it into patients? Does it mandate that we sequence right from first line to a maintenance strategy with approved second line agents? That's not my take on it. I think that there's some value in giving patients time off from therapy, but there's a risk when you give patients time off from therapy because they might have a disease-related complication that takes a good treatment patient to a bad treatment patient that might not ever get second-line treatment, which we saw in 30 to 40% of the patients in all three of these trials. So I think that the lesson for me from those three trials is that we have three lines of approved therapy in this disease, in that the reason second, third line regimens are approved in this setting is because they influence survival and palliate symptoms. And if we can get the exposure to more patients to these active agents, we're going to see a beneficial effect on overall survival. And I think that's really the lesson from these trials.
I want to see if you can translate that into a practical algorithm in terms of at least how you're approaching patients. But before I do, I'm trying to think of another cancer where you have this kind of a model, which is moving up really second-line therapy, I guess, or particularly second-line chemo before the patient's progressing with metastatic disease. Clearly, it's not done in breast or colon cancer, which is very common. I can't think of a tumor where it's done.
No, it's unique to lung, and this is why I think this is a good lesson. I mean, obviously, we know historically we've not been happy with the outcomes in advanced non-small cell lung cancer. The last 10 years has brought us an increasing number of agents with activity, but the disease setting is still a challenge in that our median age is 70 years. Two-thirds of the patients are male. It's a smoking-related disease, so you have comorbidities. So there are lots of challenges in terms of getting treatment in, particularly multiple lines of treatment. And if you do wait until progression, as was demonstrated in these trials, you're going to lose a number of patients that are never going to get second-line therapy. And obviously, if you don't get it, you can't benefit from it. And so I think this is a real lesson about how we should change our thinking in terms of monitoring patients and really buying into the concept that treating lung cancer, in my opinion, is like the game of baseball. You've got three strikes for these patients. When I see a new patient with non-small cell lung cancer, I'm thinking over time, and this is what I say to patients, that, you know, my intention is to get multiple lines of therapy in you. And I'm thinking, since we have three lines of FDA-approved therapy, that that's what I'm shooting for right off the bat. The question is, what comes first, what comes second, what comes third, and then how do you sequence from first, second, and third line. And again, I think the lesson from these trials is that when you do expose more patients to active agents, you're going to see better outcomes. And I think that's a very important message from these trials.
Well, we have to think about quality of life, too, and I'm not sure how many of these studies really evaluated that well, but it's also the issue of people like you seeing your own clinical experience. Did any of these trials really, I mean, because, yeah, progression-free survival, that probably will dominate quality of life, but on the other hand, you have side effects of treatment versus being off. Did any of these trials look at that?
No, and I think that, you know, I've just written an editorial in the Journal of Clinical Oncology that addresses some of these issues, because I do think that there is value in time off treatment for patients in terms of their quality of life, in terms of not experiencing toxicity of treatment, not having to adhere to the inconvenience of a treatment schedule and everything that goes along with that. And this was not addressed in these sorts of trials. In my personal practice, Neil, I like to give patients time off therapy because they can travel, they can do things in their lives that they've always wanted to do, free from the cumbersomeness of treatment and so on and so forth. However, I do say to them that subsequent therapies can help you. It's important that you get them. We need to follow you closely. I see them every 4 weeks. I say to them, you know, in 2 weeks, something goes wrong. Don't wait 4 weeks to come see me. Come see me immediately. So the surveillance strategy is very much intensified in my practice because I tell patients that there are more therapies that can help you after first line, and it's important that you don't deteriorate too much and become a poor treatment candidate before we assess you for what should come next.
I was thinking about your baseball analogy, and also, again, why is this different than breast cancer? And I guess, in a way, it's kind of like a high school team playing against the pros.
Yeah.
In that, you know, the disease is so aggressive and devastating that it just doesn't take very long before people are in trouble.
Yeah, right. And that's true. Even though you try to give people time off therapy, the median time to disease progression is measured in 2, 3, 4 months in the majority of patients. However, occasionally you have that patient that goes 6, 7, 8 months with relatively stable disease or maybe slowly progressing disease where you can delay subsequent therapies somewhat. But again, it's important to actually make sure that patients get exposed to these multiple lines of therapy to get the potential benefit.
Right. You know, breast and colon, people often get a nice bump, particularly out of targeted therapy or chemo-targeted therapy. But maybe you see a year or two even response or people on therapy. I guess you don't see that too much in lung cancer. So let's kick this into, and we'll talk more about ASCO, but more of a practical paradigm. And this not only incorporates the issue of sequencing, but also where you are right now, for example, a year after the FLEX trial was presented, et cetera. So let's start out and say you've got a patient who's got advanced squamous cell carcinoma. Generally speaking, what would be your paradigm in terms of selection of agents and this issue of sequencing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that how I approach first-line patients is there are really two assessments, and we'll talk about the good performance status patients for this discussion. You know, what's the best chemotherapy doublet for this patient? And is there a targeted agent that you're going to add to the chemotherapy that could provide benefit? In the squamous population, to me, it's platinum with either a taxane or platinum and gemcitabine in that setting. And I think the one targeted agent that bears consideration in the squames is the role of cetuximab. We do have the data from the FLEX trial, and it was a positive trial, although not overwhelmingly positive. When you dissect that trial and look at the types of patients we see mostly in the U.S., which are the Caucasian population, there was a hazard ratio of 0.8, which I always remind people is very similar to the hazard ratio we saw in ECOG 4599 as a result of bevacizumab. So cetuximab in the right patient can have a clear effect independent of histology. The hazard ratio for squames in adenos was exactly the same at about 0.8. So that is a consideration to me in the squamous cell population. FLEX was done in an IHC positive population. I tend to do IHC testing if I'm considering cetuximab, not necessarily because I think it's biologically sound. I think it's more in case of there are reimbursement issues in terms of it being positive, and I don't want to put anyone at jeopardy in terms of not having the test result of the immunohistochemistry.
Before you go on, so for example, how many patients with advanced squamous cell, roughly, would you say you've treated with cetuximab off study in the last year?
Probably off the top of my head, between 5 and 10.
And how did these people tolerate it, particularly in terms of dermatologic issues?
Fairly well. You know, we have the problem of the hypersensitivity reaction in North Carolina. So that does influence me a little bit, actually.
Are you using the assay that was developed to try to identify those people?
We haven't yet. I'm not aware that it's commercially available yet. It would be helpful to us in North Carolina, but I'm not quite sure that it's commercially available. So we haven't been using it. You know, in our part of the world, it would be very helpful. But obviously, that's a test that's going to have a great geographic restriction to it. So,
right. So did any of your patients this past year have infusion reactions?
A couple had mild infusion reactions. You know, back when we were doing some phase two trials with cetuximab, this is 4 or 5 years ago when we were just learning about this, we had much greater issues with hypersensitivity reaction. I think now we've been a bit more cautious in terms of selecting patients in our protocols within our infusion suite, kind of identify these early and prevent them from escalating too quickly in patients, although that's not always successful.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories about that from your colleague Rich Goldberg over the last couple of years. Sounds pretty scary stories, actually.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's pretty scary when cetuximab is the only drug that I have to go up to the infusion center and sit next to the patient while the infusion is started. You know, I don't have to do that for paclitaxel, which I have probably as many infusion reactions with that drug as I do with cetuximab. But obviously, if you have a major hypersensitivity reaction, that's a major issue in the infusion suite.
How about dermatologic issues?
You know, obviously from the FLEX data, I'll make a comment on that. Those patients that developed early rash, specifically in the first cycle, had a double in their median survival from about 9 months to about nearly 16 months in that trial. So it's of interest. So I actually welcome the rash. We haven't had patients that have had such severe rash that they've had to discontinue treatment. We work very close with our dermatologists, actually, who have an interest in EGFR-related therapies and related complications. So they're a great help to us at this point.
Yeah, the dermatologists, really, you're doing some cool stuff. Mary Lacotera in Northwestern. Yeah. I saw even at ASCO, there was actually a randomized study of preemptive supportive therapy for dermatologic issues. I think it was preemptive supportive therapy prior to the panitumumab versus waiting for them. And, you know, they're really trying to carve this thing out. Would you say pretty much most of the people you've treated have had some kind of dermatologic issues, or some of them cruise right through with almost nothing?
Most of them have some dermatologic issues. Most of them are not severe. We tend to have a very low threshold for having them see the dermatologist. Patients are interested in the dermatologist because obviously this is the one outward sign that actually something's changed and you're on therapy. So patients are very interested in managing that side effect as effectively as they can. And we've had great input and great management from our dermatologist.
I hate to ask you this question because it's sort of anecdotal, but a lot of times that's helpful. Have you seen any responses when you've incorporated cetuximab with chemotherapy that you thought were kind of outside the realm of what you might expect? You know, it's so hard. You look at a study, it has very modest effect, but you wonder, are there people in there really benefiting like we see with EGFR TKIs? We've had a couple of patients with lung cancer in a Meet the Professor series who've had really good responses. I don't know if it would have happened with the chemo alone. Any sort of gut feeling about that?
You know, I haven't. I wish I could at this point, but at least in my experience, you know, before the days of targeted therapies, I had several patients who developed these major cavitary responses to standard chemotherapy. And we knew about that. I still have some old x-rays on these patients. And in fact, specifically, they were on an irinotecan-based trial. And, and it was notable. And then along comes bevacizumab. And of course, we all know about the cavitary responses we see with the class of anti-angiogenic agents. But with cetuximab, I haven't. You know, not to the degree that you would see, you know, if you treated an exon 19 deletion patient with a TKI. Not that kind of lights out response. I've not seen it.
Now, you mentioned the issue of, quote, a platinum and a taxane. Which platinum, which taxane?
In advanced disease, I use carboplatin, and I have just more comfort with paclitaxel, although I think docetaxel is perfectly fine. We've used them both. We've had a couple trials with cetuximab that used paclitaxel, but certainly we have experience with docetaxel also.
Okay, so let's say you're going to use carbo, paclitaxel, cetuximab in a patient with squamous cell. How do you approach the duration of treatment, the continuation of the cetuximab, maintenance with chemo, pemetrexed?
Yeah, I think that that's a great question because, you know, other than the ATLAS trial, the Saturn and JMEN, as well as the Phidias trial, were done kind of before we had this paradigm of continuing the targeted agent until disease progression. And obviously, that would be a consideration with either bevacizumab or cetuximab. I'm still a four-cycle guy. I give four cycles. I tend to continue cetuximab as a maintenance. It's not an entirely convenient maintenance schedule, a once-a-week infusion. And I do the same thing with bevacizumab when I'm doing that. There are many patients that you have very honest discussions about how much benefit are you getting from the maintenance portion, and is the greatest benefit of these agents really in combination with chemotherapy? That issue has not been addressed. I personally think that it needs to be addressed with these targeted agents, particularly in light of the positive data that we saw at ASCO with pemetrexed interlotinib.
So you start out, you stop the chemo after four cycles, you keep the cetuximab going. Are you going to bring in any other chemo as, quote, maintenance or early second line?
No, if they're on maintenance cetuximab, I tend to continue that until disease progression. Obviously, as we said before, you're typically talking in the range of 2 or 3 months in the majority of patients. So it's not really a prolonged duration. I think occasionally, I've not necessarily had this with cetuximab, but certainly with bevacizumab, you get out to 8, 9, 10 months of stable disease. And then patients start wondering, how long do I have to continue this if my disease is under control? And obviously, we don't have a good answer for that. So we've done a number of things. Some patients feel strongly that they want to take a break. And some patients feel strongly that since things are going well, I just want to stay on this and not rock the boat.
Okay, so let's continue with the algorithm with squamous cell. Let's say you just give the patient carboplatin without cetuximab. Then what are you going to do after you stop after four cycles?
Yeah, in general, what I do is talk to the patient about what their scans look like. If they feel better, their symptoms are better, they've had at least stable disease, minor or major response, then I say, we're done with first-line therapy. There are subsequent therapies that are going to help you. We're going to set up a surveillance strategy. Here are the rules. I'm going to see you every 4 weeks. We're going to check a chest x-ray every month. I'm going to do a CT scan every 3 months or so, assuming you're doing well. And I tell them that there are therapies that can help you. And I think in a squamous cell patient, the consideration is either for docetaxel or erlotinib in that setting. And I also educate the patients, in addition to the benefit of subsequent therapies, that if they feel between the times that I see them that they're having a problem, they need to come see me before their next scheduled appointment. So I think at our place, we treat in the second line setting well over 90% of our patients. So we don't see this phenomenon where we're losing 30 to 40% of the patients who never get treated.
And what do they generally receive?
In the squamous population, generally my paradigm has been to use docetaxel in the second line setting, particularly in patients in the first line that get gemcitabine or carbo-gem. If I've treated a patient with carbotaxol with squam and they progress relatively quickly, I've actually used a fair amount of gemcitabine in the second line setting also.
So let's flip over to adenocarcinoma of advanced disease, and let's assume that they're BEV eligible. And I'd like to hear your algorithm for that situation A, where they have a history of smoking. And let's just say you know they've had an EGFR mutation, even though a lot of people don't have it, and it's negative, versus yeah, non-smoker with a mutation. So right, what's your algorithm for those two adenocarcinomas?
Yeah, so in the wild type patient, you know, again, I go back to my paradigm of what's the best chemotherapy doublet, and this is a BEV-eligible patient, so we're going to use BEV. I would say the majority of the patients I've treated with carbopaclitaxel, but I'm very intrigued with this carbopemetrexid-bevacizumab combination. We have phase 3 data that pemetrexid-based therapy is superior to GEM, and a phase 2 trial that looks favorable comparing carbopemetrexid to carbodocetaxel. That was some data we presented at ASCO this year. So I've been intrigued with using a regimen like carbopemetrexid and bevacizumab, and I've done it a number of times and find it to be very well tolerated and actually quite active in this setting. We are running a phase 3 trial, JMHD, which is carbotaxol bevacizumab versus carbopemetrexid bevacizumab. So the question is being addressed in a randomized phase 3 trial, but I've used a fair amount of carbopemetrexid bevacizumab off of a clinical trial.
Now, you sort of passed over the fact that you were going to use BEV, and I think right, in the United States, certainly, that's what most people would do. But he asked Dr. Perker or Dr. O'Byrne, they'll give you a strong argument for doing cetuximab, no hemoptysis, no life-threatening problems. What do you think about that?
I think this is one of the major issues we have right now. And I mentioned this before. If you look in Caucasian populations, the hazard ratio for cetuximab was 0.8, and that's exactly what it is for bevacizumab. So I agree with you. I think there's uncertainty about, in the individual patient, what is the best targeted agent to graft upon your chemotherapy doublet. I am convinced that there are people out there getting bevacizumab that clearly might get more benefit from cetuximab. I just don't know how to identify them. And this gets back to the issue of biomarkers. Can we identify those patients that are going to get much greater survival benefit from an EGFR-directed drug than a VEGF-directed drug? And I think that's one of the challenges of clinical research right now, is to figure that question out.
So let's keep going with this algorithm. Again, we talked about the wild type. You said most likely you'd use carbo, pemetrexed, bev. Right. So the patient gets four cycles again?
Yep, four cycles. And then in the Patel study that looked at this novel regimen, carbo-pem in bev, they continued the pem in the bev as maintenance therapy in that trial. I must say, I've not done that. I've typically continued bevacizumab alone. I don't know that that's the right thing to do, but that's what I've done. Some people I know do continue both components of the pemetrexed and the bevacizumab. I've typically stopped the cytotoxic portion and continued on with the bevacizumab alone. The positive pemetrexed maintenance study was done in patients who were pemetrexed naive. They did not get pemetrexed as part of their first-line treatment. So I don't think we can assume that more prolonged duration with PEM is akin to maintenance with PEM in this setting. So I've stopped it.
So the patient gets the four cycles, they continue on the BEV, and sort of like what you were saying before with the cetuximab, you just wait for recurrence and then you make it. So let's say the patient gets carbotaxol without BEV. They're not eligible, or for some reason they don't get it. Maybe they come to you as a second opinion while they're still on treatment. What would you say in terms of what the next move is going to be?
If they were BEV eligible and didn't get it first line, in several of these patients, I've offered it to them as part of their second line treatment. And I've done that with erlotinib BEV, and I've done it with pemetrexed BEV.
Now, would you bring that in before they progressed?
You know, I individualize that. I tend to wait until progression, but I have a very low threshold for what I consider progression. So I don't always necessarily wait for RECIST criteria, evidence of disease progression. If it's a symptom that's worsening, even to the point where, say, you know, just my appetite is not what it used to be, everything else the same, I'm just not hungry anymore, that to me is an early sign. And so I jump in the treatment pool very early, and before there might be radiographic evidence, there's symptomatic evidence of disease progression.
So let's go, because so far I haven't heard any maintenance strategy yet, but we'll get to that. But let's go to the other part of the algorithm. I'm thinking about the NCCN, all those arrow things. I can never follow them. So hopefully people are following this. But in any event, so you've got somebody who, some miraculous reasons, had an EGFR mutation study. I don't know why more people aren't getting it, but we know they have an EGFR mutation. And again, we're looking at first-line therapy strategy and moving on. What do you do first line, and then what do you do as things move on?
I must say I agree with your comment about a greater utilization of EGFR mutation testing. I'm very influenced by the IPASS trial, in which an EGFR TKI, in that case, gefitinib, did better with regard to progression-free survival in mutation patients compared to a platinum doublet, which was carbotaxol. So I think that there should be more mutation testing. It does demand us to get a greater size of biopsies, core biopsies, excisional biopsies, so that we have paraffin-embedded tissue that you can get a mutational study done. If you identify a sensitivity mutation, particularly exon 19 or 21, you know, if using a drug like erlotinib, looking at both the gefitinib and erlotinib data, the response rates are 70 to 80%. The median time to disease progression is 10 to 12 months. It's very tempting to use that as first-line therapy, and I think you can make a case in that setting, in the first-line setting, to use, obviously in the United States, it would be erlotinib, but I think that's the best thing. Do you add anything to the erlotinib? I haven't. I don't know that we have data yet to suggest that anything added to erlotinib is going to do better. We are planning a trial in CLGB. It is moving from the concept to the LOI aspect of it being reviewed within CLGB now, of looking at erlotinib plus or minus bevacizumab, specifically in exon 19 or 21 mutation patients.
So you start the erlotinib. Let's say they don't have that much response and they progress, or they have a great response and they progress. Then what?
Well, what I've done in a number of these patients is, if they're not too symptomatic, I actually have added bevacizumab to the erlotinib to see if you can induce a response. I have not seen a great response. I've seen a number of patients in which I was convinced that the disease was getting worse, but it kind of stabilizes for a while, and you can get some mileage out of that. If patients are progressing relatively rapidly or they're getting symptomatic, I think at that point you're obliged to switch them to chemotherapy, particularly in these patients who haven't had an exposure. And again, I think in the type of patient who has an EGFR mutation, you know, they're adenocarcinomas, they're well suited to get the regimen carbo, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab. So I think it would be very reasonable to sequence to that when you had evidence of disease progression.
So what do you think about the ALK mutation story? Can you explain what it is? And is it close enough now that you're even thinking about it in any patient to try to get it done?
Well, yeah, I think there it's not commercialized at this point, so it's more of a research issue at this time, and that creates some problems in getting it done. I actually, while I was at ASCO, one of my patients emailed me. She's actually one of the cases I provided for you. She's a never smoker, and she said, in addition to doing my EGFR mutation, could you do an ALK mutation on me? And I was totally impressed. I actually saw her yesterday in my clinic, and I told her how impressed I was with her email.
Well, Jeff Engelman was on our program. He actually presented a patient who responded to this new agent, what is it, a MET inhibitor or something?
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that's kind of scary is, how do you figure out who has this? These are more non-smokers, I guess, but
right,
it's not at all related to the EGFR mutation.
Right. And I think that as we go along, we're beginning to understand in the adenocarcinomas that there really is kind of an oncogenome, EGFR mutations, KRAS mutations, ALK mutations, BRAF mutations, you know, all these sorts of mutations that we're just beginning to understand, remind us how heterogeneous this disease is. And obviously, it's interesting that most of these mutations are in never smokers. So, you know, obviously, there's got to be a reason why a never smoker gets this disease. And it's just completely interesting to me that we're seeing these activating mutations, much like we see in GIST tumors and in CML and these sorts of things. Why do they occur? Who knows? But they certainly are biologic setups for targeted therapies. And as we get more of these agents, like ALK inhibitors and EGFR inhibitors and BRAF inhibitors and MET inhibitors, we're going to demand that we know more of the genotypic profile of our patients, particularly never smokers, in terms of how we target which therapies they should get that are going to be more beneficial for them.
I was trying to throw you a nice, you know, softball that you could hit out of the park in terms of maintenance therapy, but so far I don't think I've heard any from you.
I think that, again, my read on the maintenance thing, I prefer to think of it as sequential therapy. I certainly don't think it's wrong to go from first-line treatment right into second-line treatment. We have the FIDEOS, ATLAS, SATURN, and the JMEN trial that would suggest that that is a successful strategy. I think it's successful because you're getting exposure of patients to more active agents over time.
But yet you're not really doing it.
No, because I think also in my personal practice, 95% of my patients get second-line therapy. In the FIDEOS trial, that was a trial that gave four cycles and gave either immediate docetaxel or delayed docetaxel. On the delayed arm, only 63% of patients got docetaxel. But if you look at the survival of the patients on the delayed arm that actually got docetaxel compared to the immediate docetaxel arm, the survival was identical, suggesting that it's more about exposure to active agents than it is about the timing of them. So I think if you want to not have to follow patients closely and not have to monitor them, go right from first line to second line. You're going to treat close to 100% of your patients with an effective second line agent. And I would argue the same thing should be true for second to third line. You got to get the three strikes in to get the benefit. Again, I think treatment breaks are important. And so I like to give patients time off therapy. But I'm also saying, Neil, is that I have a very low threshold for restarting patients on therapy. I don't necessarily wait for radiographic progression. If there's something that's just not going right, I'll reinstitute therapy immediately.